well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. You know, we've been talking in recent weeks about this. It started with this USA Today story by Nick Pinzenstadler about the ATF's Demand 2 program, right? This is a program, basically, if you are an FFL and you sell more than, I think it's 25 firearms in a two-year period that end up being traced for whatever reason, you are put on this Demand 2 list. It is not a sign that you are doing anything wrong. It is not a sign that you are trafficking in firearms, but that's certainly what USA Today wants folks to believe, right? That, all these gun stores on this list, and there are about 1,800 of them around the country, must be doing something wrong to be put on this list to begin with, right? And they filed a Freedom of Information Act request, were able to get the names of these stores on this list and simply published the names of these stores. Part of the USA Today network, you know, local papers around the country then pick this up and look at the gun stores in your area responsible for crime guns. This is such an unbelievable smear. And it is weaponized ignorance, right? The only way this smear works is if people don't know what the Demand 2 list is all about, how you get on it, how you get off it. And so we're going to delve into these details with Eric Delbert from LEPD, Firearms Range and Training in Columbus, Ohio. They are on this Demand 2 list. Eric is also a law enforcement officer, so I doubt that he is willingly and willfully trying to arm criminals. So Eric agreed to join us today, sit down with us, talk about what this list is, and his thoughts on the public release of this list after years of, you know, this information not being privy to the public because, well, of exactly smears like what we have seen, and the danger and damage that can be done by weaponizing the Demand 2 list. Take a look and a listen. Eric, thanks so much for coming on the program today. It's really good to see you, sir.
Always good to see you. Always good to be here.
And listen, I really appreciate you speaking out about this because, you know, I honestly believe that one of the reasons why we saw this big USA Today story and then all of their, you know, local affiliates running the where are the crime guns coming from stories was to try to name and shame FFLs, right? That if you're on this Demand 2 list, my God, you must be doing something wrong. Even though the ATF says, no, that's not the case. I think that's clearly the intent behind these series of stories here. So I appreciate you coming on to talk about what this Demand 2 program actually is, what it means, and what you and your staff at LEPD are doing to stop gun trafficking, to stop straw purchasers, because this is something that I think is completely left out of the equation here. I in our introduction today, I described this story as relying on weaponized ignorance, right? The only way this smear works is if people don't understand what the Demand 2 program is about, how you get on it, how you get off it, what it means. And I think the gun control lobby, I think the anti-gunners in the Biden administration, they depend on the ignorance of Americans to advance their agenda. So I really do appreciate you coming on here to shed some light.
Absolutely. And that's something we're not afraid to do. We've never been afraid to call it like it is. I mean, we don't think that the firearms industry is perfect, but we always wanted to be a part of the solution. And as soon as this story came out, and you're exactly right, I felt like it was a hit piece. And, you know, there we are, a store owned and operated by law enforcement. I'm still active law enforcement. And now we're listed in USA Today as one of the top stores in the country selling crime guns. And it's already started. I fielded a call yesterday from the Columbus Dispatch. You know, tell us why you're selling so many guns to criminals. And I think she was surprised because I don't think anyone else was going to talk to her. And I said, I will absolutely talk to you. Let me tell you the behind the scenes. And it's the thing with the USA Today story. As soon as that story came out, I called and spoke to Nick, the gentleman who wrote it.
Yeah.
Got right through to him. And we had a great conversation. And he, you know, contrary to what my initial thought was, he wasn't necessarily an anti-gun person. We had a great conversation. I enlightened him with some stuff, and we have since had multiple conversations for some future stories. So I think I did what I wanted to do and to give, you know, I think all too often on our side, a lot of us in the trenches here at the stores aren't willing to talk and explain to someone who isn't as educated on firearms. And we have always said, hey, look, we will have that discussion. We're going to admit if there's something that we did wrong or something we could do better, but we always want to have that discussion.
Let's start first with that term, crime gun. In order to be put on the demand to list, you have to have sold, I believe it's 25 firearms that end up being traced or the result are the subject of a trace within a 12 or 24 month period, right? Is that the gist of it?
Right. So it's 25 or more guns that are crime guns, their definition or their language. And it is with an average time to crime. So for those who don't know that term, it is from when it is sold legally to when it ends up in police possession of 3 years or less.
Okay. Now, when you say time to crime and that phrase crime gun, I'm looking here at the ATF trace data for Ohio for 2021, the trace data that was publicly released. And they have categories of reported firearm traces. So the top category for a gun that was traced with an Ohio recovery in 2021 was firearm under investigation. The next was generic weapon offense. The third most common reason to trace a firearm, possession of firearm. The fourth most common reason, found firearm. The fifth most common reason, carrying concealed weapon. Now, obviously, not all of those things are crimes, right? So if a gun is traced because somebody's carrying a firearm, and maybe they don't have a concealed carry license, but this is a mere possessory offense, is that considered a crime gun once that gun has been traced?
Cam, it's exactly the question we asked. So when we got put on this program last year,
yeah,
I said, there's no way. We, of course, get traces in the normal course of business. And I said, there is no way we had, I think their allegation was 30 firearms that ended up in crimes, a crime gun in 2022. And I said, with all due respect, guys, there is no way that we have had that many firearms ending up in crimes. And so I kept pushing. And at some point, ATF, the director, one of the managers of the Demand 2 program, wrote me back with a definition. And their definition of a crime gun, I'm going to read it verbatim from their email, is defined as any firearm that is illegally possessed, used in a crime, or suspected by law enforcement officials of having been used in a crime. And I said, sir, there is no way. So I asked for a copy of the serial numbers of the ones that put us over the limits. You know, what? Show me the 30 guns. Now, my first issue with this whole program was that 25 number applies to anyone with an FFL, regardless as to whether you're a tabletop FFL at home selling 10 guns a year, or you're a huge store selling 30,000 a year, 25 is the number. In my mind, that should be a rolling number. That should, you know, be a certain percentage of your sales, something like that. So that was my first issue with it. When I dove in to the 30 that they accused us of, I recognized a lot of the people on the list. I went through, backed into who we sold it to, and I started to pick up the phone. And the first thing that came to was an individual that I knew firsthand, came in our store all the time, going through a divorce in that particular year, had a number of guns, I think 20 to 30 guns, had to move out of his house and called Columbus Police to go and remove those firearms and hold them for safekeeping. He was worried that his soon-to-be ex-wife was going to sell him, something was going to happen to him, they were going to get in the wrong hands. He asked CPD to do it. They took those guns in for safekeeping. A couple months later, he got himself settled. He went and picked them up. Boom, they're on our list of crime guns. I even went a step further, and I don't know if this is visible, but I pulled the police reports. I did a Freedom of Information Act. And if you can see on the CPD report, it's listed right there as not a crime. They put it down in their own report that this was a recovered firearm, not a crime and stuff, in essence, holding it for safekeeping.
Recovered firearm, which was, again, one of those categories that I just mentioned. So they don't view it as a crime, but the ATF views that as a crime gun.
Exactly. I started talking to my ATF friends and I said, you know, why are we seeing these listed in that? They said that there's been a push in the last couple of years to the agencies to run or to trace any firearm that's in their possession. So for instance, I roll up to an accident scene, I'm on duty, and the driver is a concealed carry holder. He or she is transported for medical reasons. They have their concealed carry gun in the glove box. As a law enforcement officer, I'm going to hold that for safekeeping. And now in this scenario, ATF wants my agency to trace that firearm. So as things started to roll, I really started to get concerned that, hey, we were put on this and it is simply not true. I went through, there were at least three firearms that I talked to the owners. They were stolen from their cars. And so they were recovered at some other point, but we were dinged for a crime gun. There were at least two that had their guns taken out of an OVI incident, but we were dinged for a crime gun. And so I really started to see as we put this list together, and of course I wasn't able to get a hold of everyone. And of course there was a few items in here that were taken out of threats and so forth. But certainly it puts us well below the threshold of guns that any reasonable person would consider a crime gun.
Yeah. And, you know, and I mean, when you talk about these individuals, as I understand it, one of the ostensible purposes of the Demand 2 program is that, you know, if there are a number, let's say a large number of traced firearms, and I agree with you, by the way, I think it really should be, you know, a percentage of sales, but under the ATF's definition, they say, you know, if we see a lot of these traces, very short time to crime, but I hate that phrase, since, again, we're not talking about guns that are always involved in actual crimes, but a very short time to trace, that could be indicative of firearms trafficking, right? So even those scenarios that you just outlined, you know, people who were arrested, maybe legitimately, maybe not, I don't know, but no one was arrested for a straw purchase. Nobody was arrested or were there? I mean, did you find any straw purchasers? Did you find any people who were, you know, supposedly running guns to the cartels, anything like that in your records that you were able to come up with?
No, but on the other side of that too, they probably wouldn't answer their phone when I called them either.
So right.
There's a couple of these that might be nefarious, but to your point, Kim, if you're from the outside in looking at this program, it is implying that us as a store is not doing a good job on straw purchases. That's the
right
impetus, right? You're selling guns to somebody who is ultimately using them in crimes. Now, I will remind everyone, every firearm that goes out the door here has gone through a background check. So it's not like we're selling these out of the, you know, the back of the store. So if this is the allegation that LAPD, you're selling guns and you're not catching straw purchases, wouldn't you think that the remediation on this would be, hey, look, we're going to conduct a class. We want all your employees to go through training to better identify straw purchases, and we're going to help you with that. But that's not the case at all, because that is not their intention. And as you know, what the punishment is for this is now on a quarterly basis, indefinitely, we have to provide them a list of all of our used guns in inventory. Everything about this program points towards, hey, it's a way of getting in there, getting in your books, gathering data, starting a list, whatever you want to call it, but it certainly is not what it appears to be.
You know, and when you frame it that way, then all of a sudden it makes sense, at least from the ATS perspective, to not tie this to a percentage of firearms sold, right? Because now you want those high volume sellers. Because if you've got the Bass Pros, if you've got the Cabela's, if you've got those stores that are selling, you know, 30,000 guns a year, and you got access to their books, well, that's a lot better than having access to some mom and pop shop or some, you know, kitchen table dealer who might sell 12 firearms over the course of a 12-month period. If you are, again, if that's the nefarious purpose behind this, then, yeah, you would absolutely want to structure it this way.
Yeah, and you know what? And I think what rubbed us wrong in this whole deal was, as I mentioned to you, and we've talked numerous times over the years, our guys, many of them are retired law enforcement. We have a wall here at our store. Of course, we have a wall of fame. People come in, Eric Trump and all these people come in and who shot on our range. But we also have what we call the wall of shame. And it's everyone that we've been a part of an arrest of a very bad person. The highlight being a terrorist that we alerted the FBI to, and they had no idea that person was here training other terrorists to carry out an act. We were the main store to alert ATF on a huge gun trafficking ring where it was going directly from Columbus to New York and to Canada. ATF missed it, and it was us. That indictment for those guys showed that those guys purchased firearms at almost every gun store in Columbus. And when it got down to LAPD, it said attempted to buy. We didn't sell it to them. And we were part of getting those guys off the streets. That, I think, is why it really makes me mad that we get put on this national list. You know, my phone's ringing now. Wow, I thought you guys were the good guys. And here we go again, you know, trying to be on our heels defending ourselves.
You know, and it's interesting because in Pinson Stadler's story, and I will say you have a little bit higher opinion of Pinson Stadler than I do. I haven't met Nick. I just based on his reporting, I think he does come at it with a particular angle. And way down in the story, you get this quote from an ATF official saying, listen, just because you're on the list, it doesn't mean that we suspect you of, you know, any criminal activity. It doesn't mean that you're a bad person or a bad dealer. It just means, you know, you've sold X number of guns that have been traced. That is certainly that quote has not appeared in every one of these local stories. I don't know if it'll appear in the Columbus paper, but you're right. That has been, intentionally or not, that has been the result of this USA Today piece and all of these other stories that have sprung up, you know, afterwards, is that it does give the impression that if you're on this list, you must be doing something wrong, right? You must be one of those bad apple dealers. And, you know, I've talked to FFLs who said, listen, if you sell basically more than 2,000 guns a year, you're probably going to be on this list just because of the volume of sales. I've talked with FFLs who said that, you know, they are concerned about being shut down, right? About local politicians coming after them. Because their name appears on this list. And so now all of a sudden they're, you know, painted as the crime gun, you know, seller. It really is disturbing. And as I said, this smear depends on weaponized ignorance on the part of the public. So what can we do, Eric? I mean, you're obviously, you know, you're talking to the media, right? You're not shying away from this, whether it's the Columbus Dispatch or Kamen Company. But what can we do to help dispel this misinformation that is now coming out around this Demand 2 program? And what would you like to see the ATF do with this Demand 2 program going forward?
You know, I in all these cases, I wish there was a partnership, because we are just as passionate about keeping firearms out of the hands of the bad guys and off the streets as everyone else out there. I wish we could come together with the ATF and say, hey, look, what can we do to affect change? Part of my reason for reaching out to Nick and always going at this head on is because I've found over the years, when I reach out to the reporters, and it, whether it be Nick on that level or the Dispatch or the local reporters, they tend to have a hard time writing a hit piece about us when I've personalized it a little bit. And I'll tell them, the local media knows here in Columbus, they have an open door to our range. We do, I think it's 30 to 40 interviews a year with local media. And I've told them all the same. You are welcome anytime. I am going to help you look good. I'm going to help you with using the right terminology on stuff. But the first time you flip something around, don't ever call me again. And I'm still going to be, you know, going to the other stations. And we have had a phenomenal relationship with local media. There's times where they'll call us and they'll say, hey, look, you know, this thing going on about bump stocks, what should we be saying? And they'll let me write the storyline. So I think it takes more of us to not, I mean, I think there's always been a little bit of a divide with gun stores specifically in the media. You know, we're not going to talk, but we have a message to say. And, you know, if you are a good guy doing things the right way, let's talk about it. Let's, you know, tell them, and maybe we can change a mind or two along the way.
Eric Delbert with the LAPD. Listen, I appreciate you talking with us, man. And I'm glad you're talking to the local media as well. We got to have you back again very soon. I know it has been too long since we had you on the show, but I really do appreciate your insight. And I hope, I'm going to keep my fingers crossed, that you get a fair coverage in the Columbus Dispatch here.
Yep, us as well. I'll let you know when that hits. And certainly anytime, I'd love to be back. And vice versa, you'll have to jump on our show sometime too.
Absolutely, man. Anytime. Just let me know. Thanks, Eric.
All right. Thanks, Cam.
My thanks to Eric for joining us on the program today. Looking forward to having him back again very soon. Right now, let's turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We'll start there with a case out of New York City where Mayor Kathy Hochul bringing in the National Guard and turning these subways into a police state to try to enforce her gun-free zone. Meanwhile, what happens if you, let's say, I don't know, are driving recklessly and you slam into somebody, killing them on the streets of New York? Nothing, apparently. Killer driver will get probation after completing restorative justice course. The deal will allow for Jorge Gonzalez-Cadme to avoid jail time and keep his driver's license despite killing education pioneer Norman Fruchter. Yeah, this is, the headline says it all. This is from nyc.streetsblog.org. Gersh Kunstman writing about the deal that will allow Jorge Gonzalez-Cadme to plead guilty to a charge of criminally negligent homicide, but receive 3 years of probation on the charge by completing the Brooklyn DA's Circles for Safe Streets course. Yeah, and he won't have to give up his driver's license as part of the deal. Gonzalez was accused and is accused of killing Norm Fruchter, who was killed by Gonzalez-Cadme as he was driving backwards on December 22nd last year in Bay Ridge. Now, Fruchter's widow says that she's okay with Gonzalez-Cadme not receiving any jail time. And that's fine, but she shouldn't be the only one to make this decision, quite honestly. This is ultimately up to prosecutors. And attorney Daniel Flanzig, who's a personal injury lawyer in New York, says there is silly reluctance by New York prosecutors to treat traffic deaths at the hands of a motorist the same as a death committed by another instrumentality. The fear is that potential jurors view the action of the driver as a bad choice, but not criminal in nature. Okay. So, you know, we're afraid we might not be able to get a conviction. So we'll take these plea deals and instead return a very dangerous driver, at the very least, to the streets of New York, driver's license intact. Isn't that amazing? I mean, isn't that amazing? You could plead guilty to what amounts to criminal negligence, right? I mean, this is criminal negligent homicide. That's what he's pleading guilty to. And you won't even lose your driver's license. Meanwhile, if you're caught simply carrying a firearm in a gun-free zone in New York City, you run the risk of a felony charge, the loss not only of your freedom, but the inability to exercise your right to keep and bear arms forevermore. I don't know. And driving is a privilege, not a right. So I'd say that it's even more bizarre that the city and state are cracking down on a constitutionally protected activity. We're giving a slap on the wrist to those individuals who, again, kill somebody while exercising one of their privileges of driving. Now, today's Armed Citizen story from North Carolina, where a man was shot after attacking the resident inside a home in Statesville. Statesville Police Department responded on Wednesday to a home, found 33-year-old Cameron Connor suffering from a gunshot wound. According to the Statesville Police, investigators learned that Connor had, quote, unlawfully entered the home, who was present with his 7-year-old son at the victim. The homeowner was there with his 7-year-old victim, or 7-year-old son, rather. Police said the person inside the home repeatedly told Connor to leave. But Connor, quote, persisted and physically assaulted the victim. And that is when the lawful resident inside the home shot Connor. According to police, Connor presently on probation for prior drug-related offenses. Police department says the shooting is still under investigation, but the DA's office will review the information. Connor was taken to a local hospital for treatment. Current condition not available. And again, at this point, doesn't look like the homeowner is going to be facing any charges for acting in defense of himself and his 7-year-old son. Finally, today's good deed of the day, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing on the side of an interstate in California. A California Highway Patrol officer helping to deliver a baby. That's right. who couldn't wait for the mom to arrive at the hospital. Officer Katie Price helped to assist the mom through labor on Saturday while on the side of Interstate 80 in Sacramento. Mom and baby both doing okay, according to the California Highway Patrol. They showed a picture of a Price in the hospital with mom and newborn. Price has been on the job for about 20 years or so. I think this is the first time, though, that she has ever helped to deliver a baby while on the job. CHP calling this an act of heroism on the highway. I'm just glad that mom, baby, and the state trooper made it through that okay, because, you know, birth in a hospital can be a harrowing experience. Birth on the side of a road, yeah, that's even scarier. So glad that everybody made it out okay. And, well, at least one person made it out okay, quite literally. But everybody is doing just fine. And Officer Katie Price there on the scene, able to help bring that baby into the world. We thank you for your very, very good deed. All right, that is all the time we've got for you on this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. Just a program note, I'm going to be off on Monday, so we'll be back with you on Tuesday. We're going to be talking with Peter Fraselli. He is a former ATF agent who was one of the whistleblowers in Operation Fast and Furious. He has a brand new book out. I finished it in one night last night. Cracked it open, could not put it down. It is gripping. And we're going to be talking with Pete about that new book, about Operation Fast and Furious, and that's coming up next Tuesday. And I'm looking forward to seeing you then. But don't forget to check out BearingArms.com. Between now and then, we are keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation. And if you like what you see, I'd encourage you to become a VIP or VIP Gold member as well. You'll get exclusive content, commentary, analysis, opinions you won't find anywhere else. And you'll get that warm, fuzzy feeling of knowing that you're supporting the independent pro-Second Amendment journalism that we're doing at Bearing Arms. And if you use the promo code SAVEAMERICA, you can get a significant savings on your VIP or VIP Gold membership. So thank you for your support. It really is appreciated. And I look forward to seeing you again here very soon. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.